We'll propagate the September 10, 2011 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this rain report. One could spend a lifetime just studying the myriad types of propagation that affect the ham bands on a daily or even an hourly basis. One ham who has spent many years doing just that and writing about it is Frank Biafor, WS8B. He talked about radio wave propagation at the 2011 Dayton Hamvention.
Solar activity is very often a function of sunspot occurrence. With this increased activity, we get long-distance communications in HF and sometimes VHF, but it occurs in different ways. The ionosphere, if you've studied anything about propagation, is broken up into at least four different layers. The D region, which is 30 to 60 miles up, the E region, which is very thin, 60 to 70, the F1, 70 to 140, and F2, 140 to 200, and these sometimes combined, depending on a number of things that I'm going to talk about here in a moment. The D region is closest to the Earth. It's least ionized. Now, ionized is taking a molecule that's generally stable, and through various types of radiation, you knock off an electron, and then all at once that particle becomes charged, and being charged, if you have enough of them, they'll act like a reflector. Ionization of the D layer is responsible for short hop HF communication from here to Chicago. The E region, daylight absorption of the medium frequencies and the high frequencies can be useful in single hop HF to about 1,200 miles. VHF, it can exist with sporadic E, and we'll talk about sporadic E a little bit more down the road here. And then the F region, that's most responsible for all of DX. In the daytime, this layer splits into two parts, F1 and F2, due to the heating of the atmosphere and the ionosphere moving apart. The F2 region is primarily responsible for long hops up to 2,500 miles. F2 reaches its maximum height about noon during the summer. So these are beginning to be elements that one can add in to predict this, although there are a lot of great programs today that can predict what your propagation is going to be. The ionosphere varies day and night. Because of the various temperatures that are generated between day and night, the ionosphere can expand or contract. Expand in the daytime due to heating and contracting due to cold. Naturally, also seasonal. Temperatures in the summer are different than the cold temperatures in the winter, which again affect expansion and contraction. Then there's geographical. The location of the land masses, height above sea level, and also the polar regions. The polar regions being more charged than the center of the Earth oftentimes attract ionization, and you'll see some examples of this in a moment. And then, of course, the cycles, combined cycles of all of these above. As I mentioned, the sun has the most influence on propagation. The sun itself is a nuclear reactor, changing helium to hydrogen back to helium. And during that reaction, a number of other things take place. We still don't know everything that's going on about the sun. We're studying it intently. Particularly now, sunspots are very important to understand and very important to predict because we have a lot more sensitive electronics out there, and sunspot radiation can disturb and destroy these circuits, not only the ones on the ground, but satellites as well. Solar flux. There's a tremendous amount of energy produced by the sun. The sun in itself emits radio waves. And in fact, when Carl Jansky, one of the singular people that studied and began to develop the initial radio telescopes along with John Krauss, scanned the sun. And if you ever had a chance to see one of these things, you could actually hear the radio waves coming from the sun. The radio waves coming from the sun is also called solar flux. And the solar flux is measured at specific frequencies and reported as the solar flux index. And if you're very much into propagation, you'll see that this is reported. And this can be used to calculate the ability to talk long distances. Ionic disturbances. Ionic disturbances are caused by sunspot cycles. But if you pay attention to this, you probably know that we have this occurrence about every 11 years. Every 11 years, we see a much more number of events called solar flares. There's also sudden ionic disturbances that relate to solar flares. Ionic storms. And we even get something called polar blackout, where the poles of the Earth will attract the ionized atmosphere and almost build almost a solid screen. And in fact, way back in the early days of space travel, we felt that if we launched an astronaut through that, that would damage the astronaut. We've learned since then it's not quite the case. Solar flares occur on the sun, and there are a burst of energy emitted from the sun, and they go out into space tens of thousands of miles. A solar flare can emit intense ultraviolet radiation, and the ultraviolet radiation generated by a solar flare hits the Earth in about 8 minutes. After that, particles from the sun arrive at the Earth from about an hour to 2 days later. And if you're operating HF and you happen to be on and a solar flare goes off, you would think that somebody cut your coax. Show of hands, how many have experienced that? Well, we got some propagation people in here then, because it looks like about 50% of you have experienced that. I know the first time that happened to me, I thought, what happened? The radio break? And then a few days later, the rest of this stuff comes in, and it ionizes the atmosphere. And guess what? The propagation. Then we get a whole bunch of these mirrors in the sky, and particularly on VHF and UHF, we end up having a lot of fun. Sunspot maximum occurs the average of about every 11 years. Even though this data has been recorded on sunspot activity for over 250 years, the cause of this phenomena of sunspot activity is still not known. We don't know why the sun produces sunspots. We don't know why it produces it at a peak of every 11 years. But statistically speaking, it occurs every 11 years. We've been observing sunspots quite a while back. Galileo observed them, and they began to be counted, I think, around 1750 in Zurich. And we still look at the Zurich sunspot numbers today. Sunspot activity is measured all around the world. One of the observatories that's dedicated by the National Science Foundation is the Kitt Peak National Observatory. It's located outside of Tucson, Arizona, on an religious Indian spot, actually. It rises quite a bit from the ground. The telescope is underground, and it reflects the sun image down into the ground, and contained underground are spectroscopes and other types of analytical pieces of equipment that measure the molecular makeup of the sun. So the sun is constantly being observed, not only at Kitt Peak and other places, but Kitt Peak is totally dedicated to the study of the sun.
You're listening to an excerpt from a 2011 Dayton Hamvention talk by Frank Biafor, WS8B, who has studied and written about radio wave propagation for decades. We'll conclude this excerpt from his 2011 Hamvention presentation in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available as a weekly download and podcast from therainreport.com.
There's also a number called relative sunspot number. I won't get into the calculations, but it's an averaging of the sunspots, and this is cranked into also propagation prediction. Sudden ionic disturbances are blackouts of the high-frequency skywave communications that occurs after a solar flare. A large amount of ultraviolet radiation leaves the sun. As we said, it arrives 8 minutes later. The D layer, as we talked about earlier, rapidly becomes a radio wave absorber. Depending on the attack angle, a sudden ionic disturbance could last from a few minutes to a few hours, keeping propagation completely to zero. There are also geomagnetic disturbances. These are dramatic changes in the Earth's magnetic field over a short period of time, resulting in a geomagnetic disturbance. These usually occur in areas of greater than 45 degrees in latitude, and again, because they're magnetic in nature, they affect ionized particles, which affects propagation. Without ionization of the atmosphere due to the sun's energy, high-frequency propagation would be limited to line of sight. If we did not have these reflectors in the sky, we wouldn't be able to have the DX that we enjoy today. In fact, none of us probably would exist, because radio communications across the ocean would not say we don't exist. Maybe we'll exist, but our hobby wouldn't exist. More than likely, we would eventually communicate overseas with hardline wires in the ocean and so on. On the VHF bands, VHF propagation is basically line of sight, but there are things that occur at the E layer. Ionization of the atmosphere due to reentry of meteors can create conditions for VHF long-distance communication. However, if you do communicate via that mode of propagation, you need to be really quick on the key. How many have done meteor scattering here? Show of hands that. Oh, not too bad, 5 or 10 people here. It's quick, right? You got to be there. Hello, goodbye, boom, because you're on the meteor trail and it's dissolving. One new method of long-distance VHF communication results from bouncing VFH signals off of high-altitude commercial airliners. I've been told there are hams that sit around this side of the Rockies. They know the aircraft schedule. They'll point their beam at the aircraft, and people in California will pick the reflection off of it. Not quite propagation. We're using hard objects in the sky, but another different kind of propagation. UHF is used mainly for local communications, but sometimes UHF can be part of a repeater system allowing for interstate communications. But UHF from time to time can be affected by these propagation phenomena as well. Maximum usable frequency. It defines the upper limit of available frequencies given the atmospheric conditions. You can go on the internet and find programs that predict this. It can be approximately measured by monitoring beacon stations near the frequency in question. In the United States, we have 4 beacons available from the National Bureau of Standards, and there are also beacons available from the Canadian government, and now amateur radio operators have beacons available and even input the data from these beacons on the internet. So if you're serious about DX communication, you can listen to those. But straight out, if you just set your receiver to these frequencies, and of course, this is kind of, I distributed this chart according to the spectrum, you can go down as low as 3.3 megahertz with the 2 Canadian stations, or you can move to 5 megahertz with National Bureau of Standards and so on and so forth. So you can listen to these beacons and roughly predict what your propagation characteristics are going to be. Scatter modes also relates to the ionosphere and being able to reflect signals off the ionosphere. The characteristics of scattered signal are they're oftentimes too far for a ground wave, but they're too near for sky wave. Generally, when you work the scattering modes, you'll hear a wavering sound depending on what's going on, and the wavering sound occurs because you're getting multiple reflections of the signals coming back. Usually, these signals are very, very weak, and oftentimes scatter modes come from aurora propagation. If you watch the occurrence of aurora or northern lights, it always is coincidental with a major sunspot activity. The sun ionizes the atmosphere, and the poles, particularly the North Pole, attracts all the ionized molecules, and there are oftentimes so much going on that the molecules running by each other create a glow, which is called the aurora borealis or the northern lights. And you can send a radio signal into the aurora and get reflections off of it. And if you're working aurora propagation, you'll hear a warble in the sound, and then you know that you're working with that type of a reflected mode. Of course, it's a beautiful display if you had a chance to see it. It's formed by ionized gases in the upper atmosphere, and it's concentrated by the Earth's magnetic poles. This mode supports propagation generally in the 50 and 144 megahertz or 6 meter and 2 meter range, but can stretch down to 10 and upward to UHF as well. Sporadic E, it's ionization of the E layer in the atmosphere. It occurs predominantly during June and July in the North American hemisphere, and it concentrates in frequency ranges of 50 megahertz, but it's responsible for improved propagation in 28 and 2 meters. Very popular in terms of study back in the 70s and the 80s, and that's when I was very much involved at the VHF-UHF, and so QST published a lot of articles. If I'm not mistaken, I think the amateur radio operators did more study of sporadic E than the United States government. I know the government was interested, and we did some very interesting experiments trying to stimulate that, but the hams did an awful lot of work in that arena. And it often occurs when we say summertime, summertime's when thunderstorms occur too. When you get various weather patterns moving and you get large masses of clouds moving back and forth in opposite directions, it's like taking a balloon and scraping it on your head and ionizing the balloon, the atmosphere ionizes as well and again forms one of these mirrors in the sky. The cause of sporadic E is not completely known, but we do believe it's related to the phenomena of clouds moving by each other. Its most popular theory relates to wind shear at about 100 kilometers in altitude. When it occurs, the reflections are almost like a metal mirror out there that can result in phenomenal DX and effect on QRP, especially in VHF and UHF. When it occurs and you're on 6, I used to live in Columbus, Ohio, and I'd run 6-meter sideband, and it's like I had a pipeline directly to Texas. I mean, it was just like I'd turn it down to a watt or two on sideband and be able to communicate. That's how solid that reflector was. Tropospheric bending and tropospheric ducting. The troposphere is part of the atmosphere, but it's closest to the Earth. VHF and UHF radio waves are known to travel beyond the horizon and follow this. In other words, the tropospheric bending will cause the VHF and UHF waves to follow the curvature of the Earth. It can be enhanced with thermal inversions. During the late part of summer, when we get a lot of fog and the weather inverts, you'll see a lot of occurrence of this. And in fact, VHF propagation occurs, and we can talk a lot of places because of tropospheric bending. There's also path loss due to tropospheric phenomena. In the VHF range, you get the lowest loss. In the medium VHF, medium loss. And of course, when you get up to UHF, you get the highest loss, but it's still possible to communicate via that mode.
This has been an excerpt from a 2011 Dayton Hamvention talk about radio wave propagation by author Frank Beaufort, WS8B. If you're finding amateur radio to be a little humdrum lately, you might want to delve into one of the modes Frank spoke about in his talk. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2011 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from all of us connected with Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.